first of all, thanks so much for taking time out of your busy lives to join us to celebrate books and reading and writers. It is so important. It feeds our soul, doesn't it? I don't want to keep you in suspense. Let's get right to it. Joining us today is Dennis Lehane. If you're from Boston, actually, if you're breathing, yep. You know Dennis Lehane's work. A screenwriter and novelist, Dennis has written for HBO's The Wire, which is my favorite show ever, Boardwalk Empire, and is the author of multiple bestsellers that have been turned into movies, including Gone Baby Gone and Mystic River. Right? His most recent novel is Since We Fell. Please welcome Dennis home to Boston. Malin Persson Giolito is a lawyer and writer based in Brussels. She's come all this way. Her fourth novel, Quicksand, was first published in Sweden in 2016 and sold to 26 countries. It earned Sweden... Pardon?
27.
It earned Sweden's official award for Best Crime Novel of the Year and was named Best Nordic Novel in 2017. Most recently, Malin sold the rights to Quicksand to Netflix, and it will air as a Netflix original series in 2019. Please welcome Malin to Boston. Peter Swanson is the author of three novels, now four, I've just learned, coming out, and is the recipient of the LA Times Book Award, I'm very jealous, and the New England Society Book Award. His work has inspired comparisons to Hitchcock, rightly so. His stories have appeared in The Guardian, Strand Magazine, and The Atlantic. His most recent novel is Her Every Fear. Joining us all the way from Somerville, please welcome Peter. So, why don't we start by each of you telling us a little bit about your latest novel and the inspiration for it. Peter, why don't we start with you?
Sure. So my new book is, our latest book is Her Every Fear. The very, very, very short description is an apartment swap gone bad. The slightly longer description is it's about two cousins who've never met. One is a woman from London, and there's a man from Boston, and they decide to swap apartments for 6 months. And I was inspired to write this because I travel and I do the Airbnbs now that I think I greatly prefer, if I'm going to be in a city for more than 4 or 5 days, stay in an Airbnb. And when you're there, you kind of look around and you wonder, you know, what was this person like? Or at least I do, because I'm nosy. And I wondered if two people switched apartments, if this woman who arrives in this man's apartment in Boston, as she arrives, she discovers there's been a murder in the apartment building. This is in Beacon Hill. And she begins to suspect that her cousin, whose home she's currently living in, was the killer. So it allows her to sort of search the space, this new space that she's in, for clues and into his identity.
It's extraordinary. Yes.
Thanks.
Malin, why don't you tell us about your latest novel?
Well, every time I try to do my elevator pitch, people fall asleep, so I don't really... It's about... One way of saying what it's about is to say that it's about a school shooting, which means that nobody will want to read it, because nobody wants to read about school shootings. But what it is the story of a young woman who is accused for having participated in a school shooting, and you get to follow the court proceedings against her. As you just said, I'm an mm-hmm. ex-lawyer. So it starts on the first day of the trial, and we get to follow her until the judgment. And through the court proceedings, we will also learn what she did, what she didn't do, and what happened.
And I hate to disagree with you right up front, but having read this novel twice now, it is so elegantly written, everybody will want to read it. So it's beautiful.
No, I love my book. It's the elevator pitch that I don't like. But
Dennis, how about you? In which book is this, by the way?
Since We Fell? Which book is it?
Yes.
I mean, how? Number, I think. I think it's 12. I think it's either the 12th or the 13th novel. I'm not sure. But yes, I think it's 12. So it was, I just had a desire to write a Hitchcock, do an homage to Hitchcock. Every book I try to kind of do is, most of my books are types of homages to different sort of subgenres, like whether it's historical or gangster or classic tragedy or whatever it may be. So this was my desire to do a Hitchcock, and I just came up with the idea of a woman who has agoraphobia because she had a nervous breakdown. She was a reporter, and she had a unfortunately she had a nervous breakdown while she was on the air, and she's now an agoraphobic. And the one good thing she has is she seems to have a perfect marriage to a very supportive husband. And then one day, when she's out testing herself, trying to reengage with the world, she walks out of the Fairmont Hotel, turns right, and sees her husband walking out of the Hancock in the rain, getting in a car and driving away when he's supposed to be in London. And so it becomes this question of, did she see what she actually thinks she saw? Or was it rain? Or was it her old demons coming back to haunt her? She's already had reason to mistrust what she sees in front of her eyes. And that became really the driving force of the book.
Yes, she is the quintessential unreliable narrator. Like the Jimmy Stewart character in Hitchcock's, I forget the movie.
Vertigo?
Vertigo.
Yes.
Yes, you're more Rear Window, I think, with your book.
Right.
So Vertigo, touching on agoraphobia, two of these novels have protagonists with agoraphobia.
And the other one is locked up.
And the other one is locked up. So there's this theme there's this theme that speaks to the larger world and about being isolated from it. And that seems to be a common theme throughout the world now, isn't it? I mean, we're afraid to cross borders. We're hiding behind our technology. So can each of you speak to why you chose that theme for your novel? And Dennis, why don't we start with you?
I didn't realize until I finished it that the book was actually a twin to Shutter Island. And when I finished,
yes.
I said, oh, my God, they're so similar, because clearly I have this, I don't like to know my obsessions because I feel like I'll get schematic. Mm-hmm. But then when I look back, I go, oh, I was clearly obsessed with that now twice, which is I seem to be have an obsession with the moment when personal grief intersects with global calamity. So Shutter Island, it's, you know, he has his demons, but then what really tips him over the edge is World War II.
Right.
And basically he liberates a concentration camp, and that tips him over the edge. Mm-hmm. And in this, she gets to cover the Haitian earthquake.
Right.
And what everybody forgets about the Haitian earthquake was within a six-month period, there was a 7.2 earthquake that cratered the country, which was already riven by poverty. Then there was a hurricane. Then there was a cholera outbreak, which was metastasized by the hurricane. So that was all within 6 months. So I put a person in that pressure cooker and then had hers kind of break down. I think we all feel as technology, look, Marx was right about exactly one thing, you know, which was that the more technological we become, the more disassociated we're going to become from our own lives.
Mm-hmm.
And we all feel helpless because of it. The more it gets global, the more the world gets global, the smaller we feel and the less in control.
So what you did was you took the universal and you made it personal.
Oh, I think that's what we always do. I think that's mm-hmm. what writers do. I mean, hopefully, if you're mm-hmm. any good,
right.
that's what you're doing. I mean, I think writers do that. I think
yes.
there's a group of people out there who write sort of what I call supermarket books, sort of crass commercial books, extremely commercial books. I don't consider them writers. I consider them architects of amusement park rides.
Hmm.
It's a slight difference, you know. And well done. Good for you. I like to have an amusement park ride every now and then, too. But I think there's a bifurcation between that and writers.
Mm-hmm.
So that when people say, oh, in genre, I found all this depth in genre fiction. Yeah, there's supposed to be.
Right.
You know, so.
Right. And Malin, your character, Maya, in the jail cell, at times it was.
It's
she
not
is,
an amusement park.
Yeah.
I
no, your novel is not at all.
No, but I agree with what Dennis just said, that it's difficult when you talk about the book after you wrote it, you realize mm-hmm. things that you actually didn't realize when you
right.
started out. I also realize when I look at my books, this is my fourth, that I do seem to have a tendency of writing about people that are jailed or trapped or have lost control over their lives somehow, and control over what is happening with them. And the English title for, or the American title for this book, Quicksand, really wants to point out this feeling that I think that we all have these days, that we have lost control over what is happening in the world.
Yes.
Everything from Syria to who is the actual president to at what time is the plumber going to show up. He
right.
said he's going to come between 8 and 8 in the morning and mm-hmm. 6 in the evening, and I'm just sitting here, and then 5 to 6 he'll call me up and say I'll come tomorrow. You know, you don't control everything. You have this feeling of
being pulled under
yeah.
and smothered at times.
And,
yeah.
and the funny thing is that after having finished the book, doing this whole jigsaw puzzle with the upside down as I tend
That's
to feel.
That's a great yeah. way of describing
yeah,
the writing process.
I think really that is always the feeling when yeah. I'm writing a book that I have no idea what I'm doing. But when I turn it over, I realize that this is what it's about. It's about losing control somehow.
Right.
I've read all the books for this panel, and I realized that I was very smart in locking my woman up, because as soon as these women get out, very bad things start to happen. And so
it's true.
So I was actually quite smart. Another thing that is really smart with locking your teenager minus a teenager mm-hmm. up is that you don't have to deal with all the internet stuff that the kids are doing these
right.
days. So
oh,
I was
right.
actually quite smart. Yeah.
Oh, that was.
Yeah, because she doesn't have internet access.
And Peter, your character, after suffering a tragedy, as all of the characters did, is confined and yeah. then goes out into the world in this very grand gesture. What inspired you to do that, to write about
agoraphobia? So I think two things inspired me. One was plot-related, and I think I kind of wanted to do... I'm similar to Dennis in the way that, like, I think of a new book, I think of it as, like, my Patricia Highsmith book, or this is going to be my John D. MacDonald book, or whatever. This was going to be my, when I started off, kind of my modern gothic book, mm-hmm. so like a Rosemary's Baby. I wanted a big apartment with a woman in it yeah. who felt unsafe in that apartment. So I knew that she was someone who would feel unsafe outside of that apartment. She was nervous about going out into the world, that she always retreated back into interior spaces. So then I thought, well, you know, and it's true that what you should really do to your main character is just put them through the screws. I mean, this is what an author's job is to kind of beat up on your main character and to keep it interesting. So
you sure did that.
So she starts to not trust her interior space, and then she has nowhere to go
mm-hmm.
because she's scared of the outside, and then she's also scared of this apartment that she's in, that she doesn't begin to trust this apartment. In fact, she wonders if maybe someone else is spending time in that apartment as well without her knowing it. So that's the first reason, which was really sort of a plot device, you know, a character that would fit my plot. And then the other reason is just, it's a personal reason, which is an interest in anxiety, which I've always had a certain amount of low level of anxiety problems, you know, occasional panic attacks. I think this is a pretty common thing. I've been through some of this, and I'm interested in the brain that always sees the worst thing coming.
Yes, you had a line that I highlighted, which was, she's always living in the next moment.
And the next moment is a terrible moment.
It's terrible. It's
right.
terrible.
To the point where it's not even, I mean, you're on a plane and the moment she's living in is when that plane is going to crash. I think we all do that to a certain degree. But she also lives in the moment where, like, she can't stand glass coffee tables.
Right.
Because she's just picturing them shattering. I have a little problem with glass coffee
too.
Tables myself. So, you know, I understand her from that perspective.
My chair just broke.
This chair?
I sympathize completely with this whole... Sorry.
Don't worry.
We'll see about that. We'll see. Keep the suspense up. We'll
it was
see
going
if it
great
helps.
Until the
For
chair
the
broke.
Sorry.
Yeah, so it's just, you know, it's interesting to me. And I also think... you know, people say, oh, that, you know, you love flawed characters because all your books are flawed characters. And in some ways that's true, but in some ways I actually just, I think she's not that flawed or irregular. I think a ton of people out there, as you've talked about in this world, are experiencing more and more anxiety mm-hmm. about daily life. I mean, we could probably talk the whole session about what that's all about. But I do think she's sort of a regular person, and she's trying to make her life better by going on this adventure to Boston.
Right. When she has good reason, considering the tragedy, which I won't tell you. You'll have to read for yourself.
You know, are we supposed to be writing about characters who aren't flawed?
I know.
Is that a new thing? I get that sometimes from people. They're like, why don't you write about nice people? I'm like, because I don't fucking know any. You know, I mean, I'm sorry, but I hate to break the news, but we are all screwed up, every single one of us in this room. And I just get that nothing drives me crazier than that thing of, why are your characters so messed up? Or why are your books so dark? Have you looked around? Been paying attention? You know, I was in Missouri once, and somebody said to me, there seems to be a lot of sort of sexual damage in your books. And I said, we're very comfortable talking about sexual damage in the East Coast. I said, you don't seem to be out here. And they said, no. And I said, I bet when I run home to my hotel, if I flip open my computer and I look at where the highest incidences of porn are, you guys will be in the top five. And they all went, oh, no, no. And I went, I said, I'll bet you. And I went home and I did it. You know who's number one? Missouri. Number one in accessing porn websites, the state of Missouri. So just take that with you out of this room today. I just want you to have that. But, yeah.
Well, speaking of suspense, so this panel is about suspense novels, right? But I would argue that every novel should have an element of suspense. So how would you characterize your novels? I've read about each of theirs, and they've been described as thrillers, crime fiction, suspense. But having read much of your work, I think it runs the gamut. And Malin, why don't you describe, how would you categorize your work? I would say less suspense and more literary fiction.
I think that fiction is 9 times out of 10, if we take away the poets, but I don't have anything against poets, but it's about conflict. Mm. And I mean, suspense literature obviously needs to be about conflict. Mm-hmm. It needs to be about flawed people because that run into conflict. And
it's a little redundant to say flawed people, right?
Well, my mom always tells me to write funnier stories. And I always tell her, I told her, I tried to pitch this book as the funniest book you'll ever read about a school shooting. And it doesn't seem to catch on. But where was I? What was the question? Conflict,
no, I think,
fiction.
I think you got it.
No,
it's
I do.
It's a nice book.
I do think
about
that...
About a nice girl.
I do think that a lot of, I mean, writers... I also think that fiction needs to have some sort of a hook if you want to read it, mm-hmm. in order to read it, yeah.
And Dennis, what about you? Do you even care about that?
It's not how I come into a book at all. I usually come into a book through character, and mm-hmm. I just have them... My process is a real mess, which is why, even though I produced 12 books, if you look at who I started with, my homeroom class, all of us who started, we were selling books out of the backs of our cars. It was people like... It was me, it was Lee Child, it was Harlan Coben,
right.
Michael Conley, George Pelicanos, Laura Lippman, S.J. Roseanne. Every single one of those people has produced books in the double digits at this point, 20 and up. I'm at 12.
Right.
Because my process is so much worse than theirs. They sit down every day, they do their job, they do it. I kind of futz around for a while, I think about stuff. Then I find a character who I kind of like. Then I kind of push them into a book and I see if they meet another character and if some conflict shows up. And then about 40 pages in, I start thinking maybe I should have a plot. And then I kind of send them out for one. And like a lot of times they come back and they're like, here you go, and I'm great, you know. And then sometimes they're like, pull out their pockets, they got nothing for me. And it's just this weird, there's no process to it. My favorite line about art, my art, comes from Apocalypse Now. And it's, Kurt says to Willard, "What's the matter, Willard? Don't you approve of my method?" And Ooh. Willard says, "With all due respect, I don't see any method at all, sir." That's me with art. There's no method, there's no anything. I just sort of, eh. And then after a while, the spaghetti seems to be sticking on the wall, and I think, okay, I'll go with this. And then when in doubt, this is what I think is the question of suspense. All books should be compelling. Yes. And to be compelling, there is some sort of dramatic question. There has to be some sort of dramatic question. What is the weight of this thing we're dealing with? So it's really not about the search for the Maltese Falcon. Right. It's about what it means to all the characters involved.
Right.
And it's what it means about the world. Who cares if they find the Maltese Falcon or not? Big spoiler alert. The Maltese Falcon is not Maltese. That's the punchline of the whole book. It's fake.
Damn it.
I know. You had 80 years to figure this out, so I don't feel bad. But it doesn't matter if the characters get what they want. The point of a book is if they get what they need. And their need and their want are usually diametrically opposed.
So it's all about the character for you, start to finish.
Everything to me is about the character. I don't see what's the point of reading. Mm-hmm. I read to see a character go on a journey in which they discover something about themselves, either positive or negative. Something that's life-changing. Something that I, as a character, went on this big journey. Mm-hmm. That's it.
Right.
And then I'm good.
Perfect. Yeah. Peter, how about you? Because you are a master plotter. The twists and turns are insane.
Thanks. But my method is similar to Dennis's. I do come up with a premise. I love the idea of like an instigating event. So in this case, it's an apartment swap where where two people don't know one another. So that's my premise. But then after that, it has to be about character. I mean, you have to build character into that. And if you don't get that, then it doesn't matter what the premise was. But that's where I start. I start with characters, and then I start with a premise, and then I make up as I go along. Now, as I'm making up as I go along, I'm sometimes thinking ahead and thinking, like, this would be a cool place to get to. But, you know, if I don't get there because my characters don't get me there, I'm not going to sweat it. Because I do think whenever I read a book, and 3/4 of the way through the book, I think everyone's had this experience, the main character does something that you're like, that's so out of character. Why do they do that?
Mm-hmm.
And I always think, because the authors plotted it all out in advance. And when they got to that point, they had to have do that thing, even though the character had altered as he or she had been written. So that's why I don't want to plot out in advance.
That.
I want to find out what happens as well. And I think the most, talking a little bit about what Dennis was saying about, you know, characters having stakes, one way to think about your characters is, you know, if you're writing a standalone especially, like, this has got to be the most important part of their life. Like, I always think, like, what's happening to my characters right now is like, the moment in their life.
That's a great way of thinking about
Because otherwise, like, why are the readers supposed to be
right.
there? You want the stakes to be high. You want it to be important. And then the other thing about suspense, and I think of sometimes suspense is just surprises. And surprises don't need to be a guy coming in the room with a gun, although that's always good. It can be just like, seeing your husband out in the rain when he's supposed to be on a business trip. I mean, you have to surprise your character. You really want to surprise your main character, and if you do that, I think then you surprise the reader. So I don't think about the reader, I think about what's going to rock my character's world right now. And then hopefully that'll translate to the reader.
Excellent. So something that I noticed in each of your books is setting is almost another character. Raymond Carver is known for stripping down his setting and building character and dialogue. But with each of your novels, the setting had its own presence and contributed in meaningful ways to the story. Mullen, why don't we talk about your setting? I felt as if reading it the whole time, the title is Quicksand, but I felt as if I were being pulled in under the water, which is a place where the kids went often. Why was setting essential to your book?
I don't know. I always feel as if I'm inventing new answers every time I'm on a new panel. I really don't know. I can just see that all the settings in the novel, we have the place where she grows up or where the actual school shootings takes place, is a suburb, a very rich suburb outside Stockholm, which is a very isolated environment. From the outside world, but also in the heads of people. They're very sort of stuck in their own minds and their own ideas and their own perceptions. And then we have the school, the high school. We all know what kind of an environment that is. I mean, it is a very isolated place. It's like a universe of its own. Right. You throw in a bunch of kids into this building, and you don't have to read Lord of the Flies to know that this is not necessarily a tremendous idea for developing nice situations. And then you have the jail, and then you have the courtroom, and they're all very, you know, restricted spaces where people are sort of stuck with their conflicts.
Right.
And the
courtroom.
There was
definitely the sense of closing in each environment.
And I mean, the only sort of idea or conscious idea that I had before I started to write was that I wanted it to take place in a courtroom, because to me, the courtroom is the theater that we created, we human beings created in order to solve our conflicts. Mm-hmm. And since I think that conflict is the number one, you don't have to, if you want to write suspense literature or crime literature, you don't have to write about murder, but you do have to write about conflict and how, whatever, the characters or us humans deal with these conflicts. So I knew that I wanted it to take place in a courtroom. And to me, the whole, I think that all plots are the same. I really, truly do. I mean, it's when you get ideas, you need 1,000 ideas to write a book, and I have, like, in general, 4. and then,
that's
but
terrifying.
What preoccupies me is not what's going to happen, because then you only have a few number of choices, you know. As long as you get the whole thing rolling, they're going to either end up on that way or that way. I don't know. Nothing makes sense, I know. But I can't say more than that. But the courtroom was essential to me. I really wanted to put her there.
That was very real to me as a reader. Yeah. So, Dennis, you're known for writing about Boston, although you've written about many places. In this book in particular, I was checking off all the landmarks, but it wasn't just mapping it out. They felt true. In your character, Rachel, going from a city to suburb Marshfield, my hometown.
Well, she goes from the region of the Five Colleges,
right,
which is where she's born and raised.
Right.
And then she moves from there to New York City, then she goes from New York City to Boston,
to Boston.
Then she goes to the suburbs, which doesn't feel right because it never felt right to me. Then she goes back to Boston. But I would say, well, I just want to say one distinction here. I'm with Melinda, and when it comes to plot, I feel like there's only a few plots in the world.
Yeah.
I don't feel like reinventing plot when I write. I don't think I've ever really written an original plot. I think plot is a vehicle. The story is the journey. The book is the journey. The plot is the vehicle by which we get there. And I don't know, and I don't care if a car is sweet or sleek or has, you know, bells and whistles. I just want it to be functional. I just want it to have wheels and an engine and a drive shaft, and it'll get me there. And so that's how I treat plot in most of my books. I will say,
really? Shutter Island, Mr.
Shutter
Island's
my only original.
Come on.
That's my exception to the rule. But even that, I could tell you where I got some of the ideas. But as far as place, each of my books I always feel like is a love letter to a place. So my first 5 books were a love letter to Dorchester, because that's where I grew up. Mystic River
is very authentic.
Yep. Mystic River is my love letter to the neighborhoods around the city, which is why I made it an amalgam. So it's actually, the neighborhood of Mystic River is actually Dorchester, Brighton, and Charlestown. And then I just mashed them into a little blender and spun it around and created Buckingham, which is the neighborhood of both that and the Drop. Shutter Island is my love letter to the Harbor Islands and Hull. The Given Day is my love letter to the North End and South Boston. And then Then the next two books in that trilogy are about Florida and Cuba, places that I love very much, Tampa, particularly the Tampa Ybor City area. And then this is the Back Bay. This was just, I want to write, it's the first time, everybody says, oh, it's the first time you've written from the point of view of a woman. It isn't. But that's far less ground-shattering to me than it's the first time I've written from somebody who's not working class. Rachel is not from the working class world.
It is.
And she doesn't live in the working class world. She lives in this neighborhood. Yeah. In fact, we just passed her. I was just walking with my friend. We passed her apartment building. I didn't point it out because, you know, you don't want to, like, constantly be like, look at my book. But we, you know, we walked past the Hancock. We walked past the place where she eludes a cop. We walked past just all these places. It was just, it's all right here in the Back Bay. And so that's my love letter to Back Bay. My next book, which I know is really a love letter to Boston in the 70s. I'm going to write a book about Boston in the 70s. And so it's back into my turf. It's back into Dorchester and Southie. And I'll be locking in there. But each of the books is really just, I'm a total homer for the city. I'm pathetic. You know, I'm really sad. No, I really am. I'll give you a great anecdote. I was with somebody once on the street corner on Newbury and Fairfield. I was standing on the street corner, and they said, "Yeah, you know, I get it. You like this city? It's a great city. Blah 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 blah. But why do you love it?" And literally, this guy goes jogging by, and he goes, "Lehane, you're a treasure," and he keeps jogging. And I was like, "What's not to love?" You know.
Peter, when I first started your book, it takes place here in Boston and also across the pond in England. And I was, having been to London a few times, is he going to get it? Is he going to get the language? Is he going to get the neighborhood? And you do.
Yeah, so
on both sides.
Yeah, I mean, I'm definitely a pure Anglophile in the sense that, like, I have been for a long time. I actually lived in England when I was 10, 11, 12, which I think are pretty formative years in your imagination. So I kind of picked it up from then. And then I go back as often as possible. And now I go back a lot because my books have done well there. And so I frequently go back. London is my favorite city. I feel bad saying that we're in Boston. Boston is my favorite American city. But I love London so. Partly I write about it because I love it, and partly I write about it to give me an excuse to take a trip over there for research purposes, which is always a good thing. I write about what I know, and mainly my books are set in Boston, sometimes London, and often on the south coast of Maine. My next book is entirely on the south coast of Maine, which is where I vacationed as a kid and where I like to go a lot. So I write about this area, which I love, but I'm also... It's where I am. It's where I walk around and all that. And for her every fear, I wanted to write about Beacon Hill and the Back Bay, which is not an area I'm familiar with. I mean, obviously, I've walked through it, but I don't know anyone who lives there. I wanted to find an apartment building, and I knew that the apartment building had to be important.
Right.
And I went to Zillow, actually, and looked up, like, high-rent apartment buildings and found this building, and I went and looked at it. And took pictures of it, and the doorman's looking at me like he's casing this joint. But I had this real image. So that was really fun to, like, find that neighborhood and walk through it and then
That's
be able
fantastic.
To write about it.
All right, I've asked enough questions, and I know you folks have some questions. We have a microphone here in the middle. If you could ask a question, we would love to hear it for one of our panelists. Don't be shy. Somebody has to be the first. Do you want to get up?
Someone's coming around.
Excellent.
Marvelous shirt.
So thank you. This question's for Dennis. I've read several of your books, thanks, and I've thoroughly enjoyed them. But you talked about, you know, the different themes of your books, and I'm thinking about Shutter Island, Mystic River, Gone Girl Gone, and then I just finished your most recent novel last night. And one of my question is, when I read the book on the North End, help me with the name real quick.
The Given Day.
Yep. That seemed to be a little less traditional than most of your other books. Mm-hmm. It seemed that there was a lot of history in there.
Yeah.
It was historical fiction. And so it was a little bit different. It was very refreshing. But when I read most of your stuff, I think of sort of I'm going to be reading a certain type of novel, if you will. Right. And that one was so different. So why is that one, or is it just my perception that it's so different?
Well, no, The Given Day is different, but Mystic River is very different. Look, I've laid a very strange career path that has probably leaves my publisher in tears most nights. There's a point where I left the road where I could have written. I left a predictable path, and so once I did that, once I wrote Mystic River and I had a success, and I was not ready for that level of success in a lot of ways, then I had this question: what do I do now? They're going to expect me to write Mystic River 2 and Mystic River 3, and I can't do that. That feels too much like a job, and I never wanted a job. And so I said, what's the last thing anybody will suspect? And I said, a gothic. Nobody will see that coming. Nobody will see that one coming. So I wrote Shutter Island, and then that was a success. And then I said, oh, shit, now what won't they suspect? And then I said, a historical. And I went off and I spent 5 years on a historical, and that did the damage I needed it to do because it reset my career back at as much, you know, absence does not make the heart grow fonder. After 5 years, it was out of sight, out of mind. So when I came back with a 700-page historical, my readers just sort of shrugged. And here's the thing I get about Given Day, though, and I'll just end on this, which I love. And I just like changing it up. I just do. I don't know how else to write. I need to excite myself when I write, and I can't excite myself if I'm writing what I just wrote. So with The Given Day, though, here's my sense of accomplishment with that. I only get two responses to The Given Day, pretty much primarily. And one is fantastic and seems like a humble brag, but it'll be immediately undercut by the other one. The first one I get is, that's one of the greatest novels I've ever read. And I go, thank you. The other one I get is, I started it.
Well, I'll give you the first compliment, the first part of it.
Thank you.
Does anybody else have a question?
So this question's for Dennis, too. So I know, like, what Peter was saying, kind of... Sorry, thank you, I'm kind of short. So what Peter was saying, that with plot development, that he kind of just lets the plot, roll on as he rolls on with the characters. And I've read all of your books... and Gone Baby Gone is my favorite. And just thinking about Gone Baby Gone and the intricacies of your plot and just like little things that someone said 20 pages ago which relate to the ending of the book. And I was just wondering, for you, when you kind of carve out your plot, do you like plan that in advance, or is that one of those things that just as you're kind of rolling along with the book that you just kind of land in a space there?
Let me open, because I think this is an important question for all three of us. The question is, I think, ultimately, how much do we, let me just nod if I'm paraphrasing this correctly, how much do we know when we write our plots about actually what we're going to do? And I'll throw it out. I'm just going to start with my thing, which is I don't know anything. I don't. I mean, I might know some. I usually know one thing that happens at the end of my book, because otherwise I wouldn't be able to write it. But otherwise, I don't know anything. I'm just making it up and making it up. And for all of those things that seem really subtle and intricate, there was 1,000 that were absolute crap that I luckily cut, or my editor cut, or one of my readers said, this is dumb. I have readers. I have people read my books before anybody else sees them who said, wow, this is unbelievably stupid. And they get cut. And all of those things go through a process by which ultimately, and I would say this as a we, but I'm going to let everybody else speak, but I feel... ultimately just makes me look smarter, but because I am not smart in my first draft.
Yeah, part of the revision process then.
Absolutely. I'm a three draft minimum guy, yeah. But Peter, do you you seem to be... Yeah,
I think the first draft is you're telling yourself the story, and that's how I think of it. So I'm telling myself the story, and by the end of it, I'm like, oh, that's the story. That's the story I wanted to tell. Hopefully, or I'm at the end of it and I'm like, oh, there's no story. But and then you can go back and take out what doesn't work. And you can also, I mean, through the revision process, like you're talking, like there's this thing 20 pages earlier, and I got this, I think, for Her Every Fear, which bounces back and forth in time. Like, how did you do that? And I'm like, well, it's a long revision process where I was literally like, I had a timeline. So I'm really disorganized when I start, and I'm much more organized when I finish, because I want to write down the days and make sure I don't screw something up with that. So yeah, then I go back and I plant things, or I move things so that they work better within the narrative. Because at that point, you know the story, and then you can tinker.
Malin, how about you?
I pretend that I know. I do these chapter outlines and stuff, and I put them up in my study, and we have a guest bed there. And one time when we had guests over, and they were going to sleep in my study with all this, the outline of my coming book, and one of my kids said, "But mommy, aren't you afraid that they're going to see what your book is about?" And I'm like, "I'm hoping they will, and that they will tell me." It's like, I don't know, no, so I don't know. But sometimes most of the time you just read your first draft, second draft, finalized book, and you're like, but then sometimes you read them and are like, oh, God, who wrote this?
So
those are really good days. But it is also the magic of writing somewhere. Yeah.
So none of you practice the John Irving method of writing the last paragraph first.
Well, I do. But I was going to say that there's a difference. I do think that when I get stuck, I do things like I write the backflip description. Mm-hmm. When I get stuck in the middle of my work, because then you're reminded of what you were doing.
Stay in the path.
And then I've often written the last chapter in the beginning, but I rewrite it when I get there. But it's good to know where you're going.
Exactly. And you said that too, Dennis.
Yeah, I mean, I've done things like, I remember getting to the end of the first draft of Mystic River, and I was sitting there with my first wife, and I put it in front, and she'd been reading it as I was going, and then she finished it, and then she said, "What do you think?" And I said, "Well, I think, you know, what's really great is that Dave is this amazing symbol of gentrification, and the book's about gentrification." And she said, "That's not in there." And I said, "I know, but it will be." Like, I just figured it out. Like, it figured, you get to the end of the book, and you go, "That's what I was writing about. Aha." And that's what second and third drafts are about. Mm-hmm. So the last thing I ever wrote in Mystic River is the first scene you see Jimmy Marcus as an adult.
Really?
It was the very last thing I wrote. And he's looking out a window at a coffee shop. And what he's actually seeing, he's seeing two kids playing hockey in the gloaming. And they're the kids who will kill his daughter. And he doesn't know it. He's just looking out, and he's just looking at these two kids playing hockey in the dusk. And I put that in because it, and then people will say to me later, "That was such a genius moment." Yes, it was. Four drafts later, I figured out, I know how I can introduce Jimmy. Boom. You know, so.
Brilliant. All right. Next question.
Sure. Thanks. This is another question for Dennis. Can you talk about the differences between, you know, like, the collective process of writing for film and then the solo process, and how you kind of navigate that? Of writing for books.
You mean the difference between writing for film and TV and writing for books?
Yeah, just in terms of, like, how you have to work with other people, and, you know, novels you just write, just you and a page.
Well, novels look are very private, they're very intimate, they're a relationship between you and a kind of a perceived reader. Like, I see somebody who sits in a Victorian, I can't even tell you what sex he or she is, but I see the room they read in, they read my book in, and that's who I write to. And it's a very intimate relationship. I believe that all novel writing is seduction. It's getting people to lean into your whispering. It's getting to say, "Hey, I've got a really good story." And you want them to lean in. So the relationship between a writer and a reader is actually a very active relationship. And the reader has to be very active because they can always put the book down. So they have to actively engage your words. So it's a really cool relationship in that regard. Screenwriting, I'm just going to say it. I mean, we dance around this all the time. Screenwriting is just so much easier. It's so much easier. It's just the hardest thing for me when I write is painting scenes and keeping action going simultaneously. So the hardest thing for me to do would be have a person walk into this room, because I would have to describe the room. I would have to describe you people in the audience or a general gist of that. And I would have to have that person still in motion, heading towards something, a goal. So there's a scene in Live by Night where a man walks into a hotel looking to meet a woman, and he walks in at the grand opening of the hotel, and it was the grand opening of what's now the Boston Park Plaza. It's 1926. I had to describe all of that. I checked the historical records. It took me 10 days to write that scene. You know what it would have been in a screenplay? Interior, ballroom, night. I'm good. Leave the rest up to the set decorators. It's all good for me. Moving on. Having said that, you don't when you're a writer of a novel, you're God. You control everything, right. Every single inch of it. So your pride of ownership is very different. When you write for a screenplay, you're just like a guy who paints a room. You truly are. And you paint it your magenta or whatever. But you're not part of the whole system. You're just one person. And you hand it over, and they do what they will with it. So the pride of ownership is almost non-existent. Now, the exception to all of this is television, which is why that's where I mostly work now. Premium television, the author is king. The lunatics run the asylum. And it all started with David Chase and The Sopranos, and everybody began to follow by example, and now it's just the way it is. So I'm running Mr. Mercedes right now with David Kelly, but he's pretty much throwing the car keys to me because he's doing big Little Lies. And I run the show, and it's great. It's like fantastic. I'll say something like, I want something, and they'll go, okay, we'll get that for you. Or yes, just yesterday I said, you know who would be good to play so-and-so? And they hired him. And I was like, that's insane. That is so cool. So I would say there's three differences now between how you write. At the end of the day, I'll always be a novelist. I think if you drop me on a desert island after I secure food and water, which in my case, I'd just die. But if there were food and water nearby and I found them, then the next thing I would do is look for a writing implement. It's just who I am. So.
Sir?
I have kind of a vague question. I'm hoping you can make it more interesting than I'm going to ask it.
We'll try.
And it's something to do with the nature of the insights you get about human nature through the work that you do. And I'm wondering if any of those insights might be useful to us, particularly as we think of this time in history, talk about the confluence of character and history. Anything you've discovered that might help us understand the larger landscape of human nature, as broad as that is.
Oh dear. How about it?
I would say to that, you can't make this up. You really can't. And we have some of the finest novelists sitting here. But how do you compete with that? How do you compete with that conflict, those characters and that we have in this real world now? I mean, obviously you have because I've read the books, but
I like to think of my books as sort of in an apolitical time that, you know, they don't exist with politics in the way that, like, Hitchcock movies are kind of these cool little bubbles of suspense and characters. And, you know, it might look realistic, but it's not realistic. But I will say, and I'm not a researcher, like, I like to write about characters and kind of try and imagine what they might be like, and hopefully I get it right. And I write a fair number of psychotics. So I did do a little bit of research into psychotics, and one of the really interesting things I found out is, and I think probably most people know this, but most psychotics are not psychotic murderers. Psychotics are out amongst us in high-paying jobs. And I found out that the most common psychotics, the most common jobs for psychotics are surgeons, CEOs of companies, and politicians. Yep.
And Malin, you had a scene in your book where America Barbie, and that spoke to current events and did so in such a moving way. So could you speak to that a little bit?
But I mean, when you write fiction, you don't try to, you're not a realist. You do art. I mean, art is not about trying to make things realistic or trying to copy real life. It's trying to understand real life, yes, which is a completely different story. And I do think that even if something can feel real, that doesn't mean that it is real, obviously. Mm-hmm. That's something else. We try to explain things that are really, really difficult to understand, and we all know the saying that you can't make this up because real life will always beat you, and that's not what we're trying to do.
And Dennis, what you did in your scenes in Haiti, I thought were incredibly profound. How the media sort of ignored the story.
Well, I don't know if they ignored it, but
initially,
ultimately
they
there was
it.
Tragedy fatigue. which happens all the time. And I think that there's been a concerted effort globally, but also certainly every supposed improvement has just made us stupider. I do believe that. The internet has made us dumber. Technology has made us dumber. TV has made us dumber. Streaming has made us dumber. We're dumber and dumber and dumber and dumber and dumber. People read less. People read less. People have far less sense of complexity, context, nuance, subtlety, and we're creating binary countries. We're creating black and white countries in which people say either it's this or it's this. Mm-hmm. You're either with us or against us. And I don't see how it's gotten much better. I really don't. In fact, I see that it's gotten much more. I think it's gotten worse. People don't read. And when they do read, they read what is spoon-fed to them as their own narratives that they hope that, you know, there's nothing left. And in this country, I think it all started with the end of the Fairness Doctrine. 1988, Reagan allowed Rupert Murdoch to buy off the FCC and end the Fairness Doctrine, which said that equal time had to be given to every single opinion. So you couldn't have a Fox News in 1988. You couldn't even have one in 1978. You had to have somebody giving an opposing opinion at the same time on the same airwave. And it was true of newspapers in cities, and it was true. There was a constant, healthy debate. Now it's just pick your narrative. Mm-hmm. And please disagree all. Tell me where I'm wrong. I'm all for it.
I think that almost everything is better today than it was yesterday. I think that we have new challenges, different kind of challenges, but if you look at a global or a regional scale, almost everything is better today than it was 50 years ago. Civil rights, human rights, economic equality, almost everything. I mean, I'm not American, so I'm not going to go into the situation that you are in now. But because I might agree with you that on some levels, things on a global and an American scale were better, let's say, 2 years ago.
And we could go on and on, and I would love to. I'll be at the back after if anyone wants to discuss. We have time for one more question.
So,
my apologies.
So this is a two-part question for everyone on the panel. What books majorly influenced your writing style? And, you know, the second part of that is, as writers, can you read books and sort of shut off the writer and just enjoy a book? Or can you just, as you read it, you're kind of thinking about it as a writer?
That's a great question. I can't.
So I think the question was, are we able to read and just enjoy reading? Yeah. There's definitely, when I pick up a new book, there are moments where I'm like, oh, I'd do that differently. But as soon as I'm into the book, as soon as I'm into the characters, and what I read is the kind of stuff that I like to write, which are thrillers and mystery novels. If the book's working for me, absolutely, I'm 10 years old again, like holding a book, lost in a world. And that, to me, is the best feeling in the world. And I'm able to do it, but it takes a little longer than it used to for me because of my critical eye. But that, I can shut that down pretty easily.
Malin?
Yeah, I do think that something happened with me. I've always been a reader, first and foremost. And I wrote my first novel when I was 36. And something happened to me at that point, and I started to read differently, most definitely. But yes, sometimes, obviously, the reader still gets caught the way that when you were 10 years and walked into that closet and felt not the wall, but the woods. So, yes.
And Dennis, I'll say, in reading this latest novel, I was picking out phrases, and one in particular has stuck with me and is living inside of me now, a soul bobble. And that just speaks so much to current state of affairs, people trying to find something to make themselves feel better. But for you, are you a critical reader now, or are you able
no,
to
No, I tend
out?
To be, as a reader, I tend to be like a little kid. I'm the last person, like, I'm the same in movies. Like, I'm like, he did it? Like, I'm never, like, you would think that I would be way better at that, but I'm kind of like, I never saw that coming. Like, I'm just like a little kid, like, lets it wash all over me. My friends are looking at me like, how does this moron get paid to do this, you know? I would say that with reading, the one thing I did notice was the more I read far less fiction than I ever did in my life. And it's gotten progressively worse every year since grad school. And one of the reasons at first I told myself was because of grad school. It was like I was sitting there, I was reading so much in grad school. When I finished, I just wanted a break. But then it became, no, it's an occupational hazard. It's like one of my best friends is a carpenter, and as his wife will tell you, the last house he'll ever work on is his own. Right. He doesn't come through the door saying, boy, I can't wait to fix that roof, because he just did it all day. I think about fiction all the time. It's become pervasive in everything I do. So when I get home...
So what are you reading?
I read a lot of nonfiction, or I just veg. I just get home, and that's what Netflix is for, baby. You know, like, it's like, you know, I get home, and I'm like, ooh, Mindhunter. Like, yeah, you know, like, I just don't, I don't sit and read fiction. I'm reading a wonderful book of fiction right now called IQ, which is fantastic, and it's a detective novel set in Long Beach. But nine times out of ten, I'm reading, I got a book on my nightstand. It's about the Knights Templar. I mean, oh, yeah. I'm just reading things that's far afield of what I do, because I want a break. I need to shut the head off.
What about newspapers? Do you folks read newspapers?
I do. I read, you know, I read the fake media. I read the New York Times and the Washington Post and you know, all those things that are, you know, like reporting shit. So I do that. You know,
okay.
So.
Well, I would never be able to write unless I read.
Right.
I have the most boring life that anyone can ever imagine.
How fortunate.
So, yeah, I'm a very lucky person. I really am.
Yes.
It's
not going to be so boring once Netflix comes and turns you into a household.
But I'm not going to be, I'm going to be the one that they pretend to listen to and then they'll do whatever they want. I mean, I'm not going to
have anything. Maybe Dennis can suggest
some
characters for you then.
Yeah. Well, does it actually work like that?
Does what? I'm sorry.
If
she gets to suggest a character.
Yeah.
If she gets a
Not yet.
Suggest the character.
Soon.
Like, I want
with
that
your next
actress
one.
Doing that.
Yeah. With
no,
her
it normally no, it normally doesn't, but I'm discovering now because I actually, I don't realize, usually I'm very late to the party to realize any sort of control I have.
Mm-hmm.
And so then suddenly when I suggested, they said, well, who are you thinking about this role? I had a casting call yesterday. I said, well, I really like this guy. And then they called me like 2 hours later and they said, we're going to get him. We're going to sign him.
I
was like, wow, I have that
you
power.
You will be.
Like, that's so cool.
So I want to thank our panelists for coming today and for sharing their wisdom with us. Thank you so much. Thank you to Deb Porter for organizing Boston Book Festival, which is my favorite cultural event of the year. And please, everybody, back of the room, Porter Square Books, one of the best independent booksellers in the U.S., is selling their books. Please, please head there now. Thank you so much.